again. And I am an alcoholic. For those of you who care to, please join me in opening the meeting by reciting our AA prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Well, I didn't think it would ever get here, but it did. This is the wrap-up. And to those of you faithful, hardy souls who stayed all through, we'll try to make it all add up to something tonight. First, let me remind you, please, that anything you hear up here tonight from this podium is my opinion and my opinion only. No one speaks officially for Alcoholics Anonymous, not even the book, which is referred to as our only authority, but even that authority reminds you again and again that it is meant to be suggestive only. What we share with you in the definition of AA is our opinions, our convictions, our beliefs based upon our experience. So anything that I say can be held against me, but not against AA. If you keep that in mind, then nothing I say need bother you at all. The second thing is I saw a lot of hands go up of newcomers. I hope that most of you have been here during these past weeks, but to bring us up to date, because there's a lot of ground to cover, let's review, a brief review, so that we can all be on the same train, on the same wavelength, all going in the same direction tonight, and all finish up at the same place. You'll recall that when I started this 5 weeks ago, I quoted from the next to the closing paragraph of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The sentence that says, see to it that your own house is in order. And if this is the case, then great events can come to pass for you and countless others. So we set out to see if we could build a house for ourselves in which we could live, and if it could be built sturdily enough, soundly enough, and have enough warmth and hospitality that maybe someday we could invite others to share it and help them find there the shelter that we had had to ask from others who went before us. And we started out by asking ourselves a series of questions. The number one question of the first meeting, which is, in my opinion, the fundamental requirement for recovery from alcoholism, it's the basis without which there's nothing else, is what is the point of sobriety? And you remember we examined this at length with the conclusion that if you're an alcoholic, the point of sobriety is life itself. It is assumed that if you have made a decision to stay sober, being an alcoholic, that you have chosen life rather than death. And since for you and for me, sobriety is an indispensable necessity of life, then that is its point. It isn't to be followed or achieved or maintained or held on to for rewards or because it can bring you fringe benefits or dividends. It is an end in itself, an indispensable end in itself, an objective on which you can place no value, any more than you could try to place a value on your life. The second week, we asked ourselves the question, is it necessary to have a spiritual experience in order to maintain sobriety? And we define spiritual experience as it's set forth in the appendix to the book. And that being a slow, gradual change in a person's attitude toward reality. Not the sweeping religious experience or supernatural happening that many think is necessary, but what is set forth in the book that really, in the great majority of all of us, is what really took place, that over a long period of time, with a lot of effort and a lot of work, became a gradual change in our reaction to the world around us, to ourselves, and to the people in our world. With that kind of a definition of spiritual experience, you remember that technically the answer to that question then would be no. It is not necessary to have a spiritual experience, to undergo a spiritual experience, in order to achieve and maintain sobriety. You don't have to be anything. You don't have to get anything. You maintain sobriety by staying away from the first drink. And in order to do that, you don't have to be virtuous. You don't have to be spiritual. You don't have to be rich. You don't have to be poor. You don't have to be anything. There's only one thing that has to be in your mind, and that is that you must value being sober more than you value being drunk. And based on that evaluation, have made a choice. However, if you extend this question and say to yourself, do you want to have a life worth staying sober for? Then, remember, we stayed on that for some time, and the answer to that question is obviously yes. A spiritual experience would have to be. There would be no other way to do it. And in that week, we talked about the steps of AA, the first five steps that put this spiritual experience into motion. The third week, we asked ourselves the question of what are the old ideas? The old ideas that we arrived here with, and the old ideas that have brought us to the state where we have to seek help from a power greater than ourselves and from our fellow human beings. And if you remember, we discovered in that meeting and in that workshop that we really, as alcoholics and our neurotics, were motivated all our lives by an unholy trinity of guilt and anger and fear. And that in order to survive, in order to maintain some kind of ability to function with this kind of tension, this kind of torment and haunting fear, that we had embarked on a double-pronged program of balancing a neurotic need for approval against an equally strong motivating factor of a need to dominate, a need to be the strongest, a need to excel, to compete, to humiliate. Now, last week, we asked ourselves, well, if this was the trinity we served, if these were the masters that we served, if this was our desire, how did we implement these two motivations that were really wiping each other out all the time and causing the tension? Because after all, the definition of tension is conflict. It's two opposing forces pulling in opposite directions that creates tension. And we took up what we might call the neurotic nine, the nine little games, little techniques that we thought we were putting together as a do-it-yourself survival kit, when in fact what we were doing was slowly but surely, with great intelligence and great ability and great skill, slowly destroying ourselves. If I can refresh your memory so that we can now go on to tonight's subject, I don't remember in what order I gave them, but they were this: religion, booze, or any other chemical that can be taken to change your reaction to reality, sex, the critic, the martyr, the loner, resentments, the neurotic need for infallibility, and the neurotic need for a crisis. It was quite a little chip, and we examined them at length and figured out how they worked and what uses we were putting them to. Now, tonight, let's assume that we've all stayed along this far. We've all bought all of this. The obvious question is, if in understanding where I have been and what put me there, how in the hell am I going to get out of there? There's a great line in the book that says, self-knowledge alone is not enough. Now, I subscribe to this 100%. But without self-knowledge, you never know what you're fighting. You're fighting phantoms. And you never know where you're going, and you never know what's pulling you there. But once you get there, once you see this self-knowledge, once you find it, there finally has to come a choice. Because this is what's behind the line in the book that many of us tried to hang on to our old ideas, but the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Now, why would we hang on to ideas that were killing us? The answer is very simple. In our state of mind, operating under the motivations and the forces that were controlling us, it was clear to us, with crystal clarity, that this was the only way that we survived. This is the only way that we could function. This is the only way we could get from here to there and back again. So you don't give up convictions like this easily. You don't let go of them overnight simply because somebody like me or anybody else says, you know, Bud, these things are wrong. And they're driving you down into the ground. Let go of them. Just walk away from them and never say anything to them again, and you'll be all right. You know, just that wonderful expression that you've heard so many times in AA, which I tried for years to practice, let go and let God. And I went around literally letting go, except everything kept sticking. And I kept finding it again and again and again. Now, if you'll keep the neurotic nine in mind that we just went over, I'll try to tell you what I think and found out in my opinion that wraps this up, how you can take the self-same old ideas with the same talent, the same energy, the same zeal that you devoted to knocking yourself out to turn this whole thing around and instead of destroying yourself, start building yourself up. I hope that by now it's clear to all of you, as it finally became clear to me. If you got it in 5 weeks, I congratulate you. that what we all walk in here with, that if we all boiled it all down to one thing, that what brought us all through the doors of an AA meeting, it was the conviction that of ourselves we had no worth. Now, this was in all of our minds, no matter how we acted, no matter how, whether we were timid or grandiose, whether we were shy or belligerent, whether we wept or snarled, this was really what was inside of us, that of ourselves, we had no worth. We were filled with self-recrimination, self-abnegation, the great colossal self-put-down, which sometimes showed through, but most of the time we kept hidden. Now, but then, if this is the case, then what finally becomes our objective? It's to turn this around. To turn this around and not only quit not liking ourselves, end up literally having a love affair with ourselves. I thought that this would be pretty hard to do. I remember one time, after about 3 months or 6 months, really, with the meter running, I one day said to my doctor, "Doctor, what are we doing? What are we after? What is our goal, doctor?" Now, very organized, always in there. And he said, "Mr. McGinnis, it's very simple. We're trying to improve your self-esteem." And little did I know then that I was going to become one of his most successful patients. So, let's try now to go through some of these things that they come to seven. It's a very nice, lucky number. And some of you have heard these before, and I'm repeating them tonight for two reasons. Number one, they become more valid in my life with each passing day. And number two, so many of you have asked me to repeat them, and I don't see any point in trying to come up with new ones to entertain you when these work, at least as far as I'm concerned, they work. And I'm going to try to give them to you in the order I think that they have to be worked. At least it was the way that, of course, nothing ever falls into any such perfect order as you put it out in the book or in the little pamphlet or in the essay. But mainly, they come pretty much along this way. Now, you're going to run into your number one stumbling block. It's the number one thing that is going to be the first rule. Because it's what you arrived here with. It's what kept you going for years. On the darkest day or the longest night, this was really what kept it in there plugging away, and you're going to hang on to it. So the first rule I'm going to give you is renounce the remorse. I remember some years ago reading in the works of a theologian who shall remain nameless this line: shame is the next best thing to virtue. And I believed it. I thought, well, that's good. I'm glad I read that, and I'm glad that he promulgates this theory, because I've got so much of this shame that I must be the next best thing around that you can find. I hesitate to think how much harm this theory has done, but it is very widely held. That if you can't be a saint, the next best thing to do is to go around killing yourself because you're not a saint. Now, this This looks like a virtue. So why should you want to let go of it? Let's pick up this remorse now in our middle fingers and see. Let's try to see what it's made up of. Let's see if it's this great thing that we think that we should cling to and that really makes us pretty great people, because we're very, very sorrowful that we've been so rotten and we made all these mistakes. What is this remorse? What is this regret? When you really look at it, it is nothing more nor less than more of the anger that is turned in upon yourself. What it is a sense of outrage that you have failed, that you haven't been the perfect person that you thought you ought to be and that you were told you should be and that is constantly held out for you to be. How many times have you heard yourself saying, how could I do that? How could I think that? How could I be that way? What the hell's the matter with me? It goes back to that childish thing that we talked about, when you're little, tiny, and the figures of authority in our childhood, the giants that shaped and mold us, kept saying, you've got to be better. Do it better, do it better, do it better. You can be better if you just try. You can be better if you just try. So it's this same thing turned in on us again, the remorse, the regret, the sense of outrage that we have failed. It's really nothing more nor less than pride turned in against us. And when you look at it this way, then you see it for the neurotic thing that it is, you realize that it is a further handicap. And you see, the trouble with this kind of thing, after you've thought it all over, and you realize and felt how terrible you have been, and you feel so sorry about it, and you're so filled with remorse and regret, what is the logical thing to do? Well, the logical thing to do is to go out and celebrate this by being more guilty. Get some more things done, you know, do some more things that you can feel more remorseful for, and this way we keep it going. We never do get around to changing. We don't have to. We can just go along feeling sorry. Besides, this keeps giving all of our friends and all of our family and all of our relatives this wonderful out that he would be such a wonderful man if he could only find out what's wrong. But so the number one rule is renounce the remorse. Now, this leads right into the second one that I call look at the evidence. I'm going to try to give you examples out of my own life of what I mean by these, because that's the only way that I know. Sometimes maybe they will not apply to you, but maybe you can adapt them to whatever it means in your point. These old ideas that I was telling you about, they seem so logical. And the reason we cling to them is because they do seem so right. Many of them we were taught. And what makes it doubly difficult is nearly all of them are partially true. But, for instance, where I learned that I had to look at the evidence was, and I think maybe I've mentioned this before, I arrived at AA, or any other place in my life, or any other difficulty, with the conviction that I, being a cradle member of the one true universal church, that I had, already had, and already knew to my fingertips, all that I needed to know. I knew how to face life, I knew how to cope with it, I knew how to do everything. Now, if this couldn't work, then what the hell else was going to be found? It was obvious there couldn't be anything else, so I would dismiss it. I finally had to look at the evidence. Well, what was the evidence? The evidence was that whatever was the matter, it wasn't working. That was the evidence. Either I was wrong, or the religion was wrong, or the way I was using it was wrong. Now, I don't want to carry this forward to where all of a sudden people are interpreting that I'm giving a blanket condemnation to religion. I don't mean this at all. I mean that what I had to back up and see was that the evidence in my life was that something was wrong. Something I was doing was seriously wrong, or I would get better results. So this was the number one thing that I found that I had to learn to do. I had to be willing to do this. I had to have enough of an open mind, enough that brought me there by sheer logic to examine everything in my life. I did it with my job. I, after a period of time of putting forth my best efforts and constantly having what I would call less than perfect results, I had to look at it and say, if all these fine rules that I formulated for myself, and I had an SOP for my department, a standard operating procedure, that single space was about this thick, and by God, they followed it. Well, sometimes we weren't getting very good results. This, again, is a place where I had to look at the evidence. And I ask you to do, urge you, suggest that you do the same. Whatever area in your life you feel that you, this is it, this is right, there can't be any flaw in this, I've gone all through this and I've arrived at this suggestion and this is the way it is. If the results that those convictions aren't producing are not constructive, then I think somewhere along the line you have to back up and look at the evidence. Now, this leads into number three, a game that I find that I have to constantly play, called Who's Who. Now, you'll remember when you were here for the third, if you were here for the third meeting, and we talked about this guilt and the anger and the fear that started as a child, as a very tiny child, and is in our childish way we came up with this neurotic way to cope with it. If you will remember, we went that all of us had certain figures of authority in common. There was always the mother, the father, the teachers, the relatives, the older brother or sister, all of these people who shaped, who molded what we became, and where we first learned to, quote, cope, unquote, was in this childhood environment. Now, the main thing that the neurotic does, the thing that really he does all along until he finds out that he's doing it, is he keeps reacting to the present as if it were happening to him in the past. In other words, everything that comes into his life, he relates back to how he learned to cope with it as a child. So therefore, he turns the major, influential, important figures of the present into corresponding figures from the past. Bosses become fathers. Wives become mothers. Husbands become fathers. Our sons. Our rivals. So that we set up a drama. And we keep dealing with these people, not in the role that they really are, but in what we have found as a child we could cope with, or we thought we could cope with. I turned every boss I ever had, whether they were younger or older or what, dumber, smarter or what, I turned everyone I had, tried to rather, into my father. I never ever really was intent on anything except making the boss like me. Because you see, if he liked me, that's like I tried to get Dad to like me, then he'd take care of me. He would protect me. He would see that things would be all right. So I was, I remember how I used to read about paternalistic government and think, oh, isn't that awful? That's bad. We should all be rugged individuals and every man for himself. And here I was going around, you know, just seeking for fathers everywhere. Any time they showed up, they had on a pair of pants and looked halfway intelligent, there's a candidate. I did this in other ways too, and I'm sure that you have. But when you find yourself playing these games, when you find yourself sometimes treating those who are important to you in certain ways, and that there is a certain undesirable results coming from it, sit down and think about it. And think, do I look upon her as my wife, or do I look upon her as my mother? What am I trying to get her to be? In any close situation, which really makes the difference between whether you're going to function or whether you're not. I don't mean that every time you walk out on the street and get on the bus that you have to say to yourself, who the hell is this? No. No. Or if you walk into the elevator and you don't know them and you see a little funny thing going on, you have to think, I wonder who I turned that person into. It's the people that are in your very intimate, the people that make the difference. The bosses, the children, the husbands, the wives, the lovers, the mistresses, etc., etc. They all have roles. There's many a wife who's a daughter and many a mistress who's a mother and vice versa. Some of them are even sisters. Now, if you've got those three things, let's move on to what I think really, as far as I'm concerned, was one of the things. I have to keep relearning it over and over and over. In fact, I have to keep relearning all of these things. That's what makes it interesting. And I've covered some of these before, and we'll tie them back in together now. Try to remember this one. Effort is everything. From here on in, I urge you to consider dropping from your vocabulary for all time. Phrases like best of my ability, all or nothing at all, and all that ilk that have their roots in this tyrannical need for perfection. I think probably there isn't any more serious stumbling block to recovery from serious neurotic tendencies than this. Remember, one of the neurotic nine was the need for infallibility. Another name for it is perfectionist complex. Is this insistence, this demand, that everything in your life must be perfect. You demand it of other people, you demand it of institutions, but above all, you demand it of yourself. And this is founded in guilt. This awful feeling of unworthiness, this feeling that we of ourselves we have no worth, so therefore we don't dare be wrong, we don't dare be less than perfect. We have got to have it right. Yesterday morning, I spent 2 hours with the priest that I took my fifth step with some 15 years ago. I hadn't seen him in a while, and I drove up. He's now the prefect of the St. John's Seminary at Camarillo. And I drove up there, and he and I spent 2 hours in his office and another half hour walking through the grounds. And when we got all finished, after all this time, he and I were in complete agreement. It probably still in me the biggest thing I have to constantly concern myself with is this stubborn, subtle, omnipresent struggle for perfection. The inability to accept myself as a fallible human being that works in me constantly, over and over and over again. And I was telling him how a long time ago, when I was reading the New Testament, I came across the phrase that I don't remember now, I might be wrong, but anyway, somebody asked Christ, the Master, what he must do. And Christ turned to him and said very simply, take up your cross and follow me. And I said, am I right, Father, in the assumption that I made then, that the cross that Christ was referring to is the cross of our human nature? And he said, yes, as every theologian since from the very beginning has agreed on this. This is what he's referring to. He wasn't referring to some kind of great burden, some kind of special thing he was going to give, some selected one to carry, some awful disease or something like that. It was the cross of the day in and day out fallible human nature that you were to live with. And in learning to live with it, be 10 times more at peace with the weakness within you than you are in this constant striving for perfection. You know, long before the theologian, long after the theologians promulgated it, all of the psychiatrists and psychologists agreed that every man's greatest weaknesses are also his greatest strengths, and vice versa. His greatest strengths become his greatest weaknesses. That's the way they work. So you cannot despise these weaknesses, and you can't try to overcome them. Turn them around, properly regard them, and they become your greatest strengths. A knowledge of your own fallibility, an acceptance of it, an unqualified acceptance of it, becomes the greatest strength and the greatest safeguard and the greatest force for stability in your life. The next one I call break the circle. Now, the last time I tried to tell this to somebody, discuss it with them, I finally saw that I was getting it to them all wrong, or else they were hearing it wrong, because what they got in their head was that for the rest of their life they were going to have to stand like a dumb ox while the human race rained blows upon their heads. I wouldn't do that for nobody. And I don't advise you to do it. What I mean by breaking the circle, and here again, this applies to those situations in your life that really matter. You know, if you only see somebody about once every 2 years, you don't have to worry about breaking the circle. It's broken. It's the day in and day out, the close friends. You have to apply these things daily. Now, what I mean by this, and it's so common, I don't know, I've yet to find the life
situation of a person which somewhere in this, it doesn't exist. And that is the only thing I can call it is the dance of death that two people get into. They get locked in this. And when one moves forward, the other one moves forward. When one moves back, the other moves back. It's a dance. And they have to do it. They have to cooperate. They don't look like they're cooperating, but they're cooperating. And that's the funny part about it. This is what took me so long to see. Now, again, I've had to illustrate it with a situation out of my own life that certainly bugged me and nearly drove me up the wall, but it did drive. In this kind of a situation, the roles are always unconsciously understood. Each one knows his own role, and he plays it, or else they don't have a dance. See, somebody leads and somebody follows, and there is a signal that is given when the dance is to begin, and they go into it. Now, with my boss, who I had a dance of death with for 9 years, we learned the steps real good. My role was the role of the humiliatee. He had the role of the humiliator. Now, we had to react, or we didn't have a dance. And I'll tell you how it was done. And I'm sure that you can now figure out where it goes in your life. Generally, these dances are done with audiences. Children, other co-workers, neighbors, good friends. It's much better when these dances are performed with an audience, because each one now can get his role in there. Now, the way it happened with me was generally there was a conference. It was always, of course, it could happen at any hour of the day or night, but when we really did the dance at Beth, when the symphony orchestra played back in the wings, was generally when there was a conference. And there was some kind of a big, important decision that had to be made. And the humiliator, my boss, sat there. And we all trotted out our little wares. And then would come my turn. And the signal would be given. The signal would be given with something, "Well, let's see what Mac has." That was the signal. See, the dance is going to begin. Right away. Yes, yes, okay. Strike up the music. Now then, I gave trotted out my wares, always on the defensive, pushing, 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 you know. This is the greatest, this is the finest, I've given this a lot of thought, I've prayed over it, you know, and here it is, and here it is, and it's great, it's the only thing that can solve the problem. Next step in the dance, what the hell made you think that would work? My turn. Then we go into frothing at the mouth, denunciations, accusations of being misunderstood, accusations of not knowing what the situation was with the client, etc., etc. Now, it always ended up the same. I always played right into his hand. The dance always had the same conclusion, because I always ended up with the paternal. The father said, patted the son on the head, and said, "You know, Mac, you're so emotional. You know, you just can't take any kind of objective criticism. It's true you have a certain amount of talent, but God damn it, Mac, you know, you're going to have to learn to be an adult." And then I would go away defeated. I had played my little role, and he had played his, and the dance had been danced, and then it never failed. We did this over and over and over again. It finally, when I saw that my role in that the only way this circle was going to be broken was that I would have to change my role. Now, how do you change your role? He's the boss. Am I going to be able to become the humiliator? No, not and stay around for a while. The only thing I could do was quit being the humiliatee. And that's what I call breaking the circle. Because finally there came a day, I don't know how it ever happened, that I thought about it, I thought about it, I thought about it. Of course, I was doing a lot of work, spending a lot of money, doing a lot of praying, etc. But one day this situation, the signal was given. Let's see what Mac has. The same old signal. And this time, Mac, who had also decided to put into effect what the next one we're going to take up, the next movement, laid his stuff out very matter-of-factly, as though he was in a bunch of front of a bunch of people that he'd never seen before. Now, this takes a little bit of acting and takes a little bit of control, and little things are going on in your stomach. And you might break out in sweat, but it can be done. Now, came step number two. Whatever the hell do you think would make that work? I never saw anything like that in my life. What do you think of it, guys? Well, time for my step. I said, Monty, you know, you may be right. You know the account a lot better than I do. After all, you're the regional manager. You were once the account supervisor on this account, and I'm sure that you probably have a better judgment of this than the client himself. So I think you ought to make the decision whether or not it should be shown. And I left. I wasn't humiliated. He had his dance right back in his lap because he had to make the decision now. I had broken the circle. Now I had to do it again and again and again. But you know what happened? If nobody dances with you when you get up to dance, you finally quit dancing. He finally got to where he quit getting up. He quit giving the signal. And he found somebody else to take my place. They were all ready and willing and able to move in. Now, this leads to the next one that the name I've given to it is Let the Tailgater Pass. And the reason I've given that this name is I'm sure that anybody, any alcoholic, has been on the road when suddenly he becomes aware in the mirror that there's somebody right on his tail light. What is your, let's face it, what's your first reaction? You know damn well that I've all heard. And then he goes over this way, then you go over this way, and then you go there and this way. Both of you now rush pell-mell toward destruction because he isn't going to get past you. Now, this goes back to that childhood thing of be better, be better, be better. Don't bring home just B's and C's. Bring home all A pluses. Don't let anybody get ahead. The need to compete, the need to dominate, the need to... Now, how can you take this self-same thing and turn it around? Now, you're going to think I'm cracked because I'm going against everything that we've ever been taught. I'm going against the precepts of our culture, the precepts of the great American dream. And I am telling you to consider this and consider it hard. I am urging you to stop competing. Let the tailgater pass. What are you, you're going to say, McGinnis, are you really standing up there, supposed to be in possession of your senses, and telling me not to compete in today's world, in today's society? That is exactly what I'm telling you to do. Because competing is the neurotic part of the activity. I'm not telling you to downgrade yourself. I am not telling you to employ your talents to the fullest. I am not telling you to give everything that comes up in your workaday job or in any area of your life, everything that you have to give it. I am telling you, stop making it a do or die competition. I put this to the test. I put my money where I mean that literally. I put my job where my mouth is. I put it to the test, and I put it to the test in one of the most competitive businesses that's around. I think next to show business, advertising is just about as cutthroat as anything that I know of. As a matter of fact, knives in the back, they've discarded knives in the back. They use laser beams now. But I put it to the test. I stopped this competing. I stopped this knife in the back. I stopped this constant put down. And I'll tell you how it worked out. Sooner or later, your work is going to be judged by somebody who's not in the neurotic rat race with you. Sooner or later, somebody who's not in this competition comes in on the ground. No matter how much bugle blowing the other guy has done, no matter how many knives, no matter how much he's put you down, no matter how much he's cut your throat, sooner or later, the question, the product you've turned out, whatever you're doing, it's going to be evaluated by somebody who's not in that particular neurotic rat race. He may be in another one, but he's not in that one. And he'll be able to evaluate it. And I tell you that good work, talent, ability, efficiency is so rare in this world that you don't need to worry about how good you are at cutting the other fellow down if you are good at what you do, are reasonably adequate. Because the old saying that the path to the better mousetrap still holds true. And the funny part about it is, you do better work. I found I did when you get out of all of the energy, all of the thought, all of the time, all of the hatred, all of the thinking that you have to do, the resentments and the staying up nights that you have to figure out how you can get ahead of that bastard. When you don't have to do that and can turn your energies and your talents around to the situation, to the question, to the problem, you do far, far better work, and it's much more quickly recognized. Any area of your life where you're in competition, stop competing. Let the tailgater pass. Let him run on to his doom. You'll get there in time to see the ambulance taking him away. That's all you need to do. The last one I'd like to tell you is the price right. Now, this one, you don't play it very often, but boy, oh boy, when the time comes, you really have to play it. Everything in life has a price tag. Success has a price tag. Failure has a price tag. If you're going to stay sober, that has a price tag. If you're going to go down on Skid Row and drink for the rest of your life, that has a price tag. Somewhere along the line, you know, virtue has a price tag, sin has a price tag, everything has a little price tag on it, and you have to pay it. You have to pay it. Somewhere along the line in your life, in situations that really matter to you, you have to sit down one day and say, can I afford to pay the price for that? Do I want it? Do I want what it offers bad enough to pay the price tag that's on it? And then you're able to make a choice. Well, for instance, I go back again to this situation that bugged me for so many years. I don't know how many times that over in this situation with my boss in the 9 years that it existed, I seriously considered leaving the agency and resigning and going and finding another job. Now, there were advantages on both alternatives. If I got out of this situation, there was the advantage of being out of the situation. The other drawback was that I had a great equity in this agency. I'd been with them for years. I was a stockholder. I had profit sharing, and I had a severance agreement with them. Besides, I was a vice president. I had recognition with this company. And no matter where you go in the agency business, no matter what kind of a title you have hanging on to, or what kind of a proof book you take with you, you prove yourself wherever you go. You have to prove yourself all over again. It's like in the theater. How good was your last play? What was your last movie like? What billing did you get? Not did you win the Academy Award 5 years ago. What was the billing on your last picture? I had to sit down and make a choice. I had to pay a price. And this is where you weigh. You weigh what you want, knowing that there is a price tag on, and you're going to have to be willing. Believe me, I think the best definition that I can think of emotional maturity is the ability to choose what you want to do, to make a choice as to what course of action you wish to follow, and then the acceptance of the consequences that go with that choice. The two are, they can't be separated. You can't make the choice and then refuse to pay the price tag. That's emotional immaturity. The two have to go together. And that's what I think, that's the name of the game, really, when you end up. The ability to live your life by saying, I choose this course of action, I have waited, I know what the price tag is, and now I am willing to pay whatever the tariff asks. And once you've done that, then keep your mouth shut. You just make a bargain with yourself and you keep your mouth shut. You don't go through life every time anybody, you can get anybody in a corner, start this crying around about trying to have your cake and eat it too. If you play this game, you don't have to get on the telephone so often or run around doing so much advice asking by saying, what do you think I should do? Because, of course, what you're trying mainly to do in that situation is to get somebody to agree with a course of action that you have already decided to take and assure you that the price isn't going to be any price at all. You know, everything's going to be fine. And you keep shopping around until you find this. And since somebody's always going to think the way you do on any given moment, and somebody is always going to think the other way on any given moment, one day you have to make up your own mind anyway. So you might as well decide that you're going to be happy on your own time or be unhappy on your own time. There's no use getting anybody else in the act because nine times, you see, they don't have to pay the price. And they can give you all kinds of advice. But you're the only one who can choose. You're the only one who can pay the price. And now I'd like to end up here, because I want to save a little time for some questions, with, I'll give you a little secret. And it's something really, really simple. It took me a long, long, long time to discover this. If you want to take a giant step tonight toward peace of mind and hold on to it for the rest of your life, drop two words out of your thinking and out of your vocabulary. Never let them come past your lips again as long as you live. Now, they'll come into your head, but you'll never let them be spoken again. And the two words are, if only. This is the litany of the defeated. This is the refrain of regret. And all it does is keep pulling the rug out from under you. Now, they will come into your mind, these words will come into your mind because it's part of the remorse. Part of this neurotic need to punish, part of this neurotic need to regret, part of this neurotic need to put yourself down, to compare yourself with others, to be constantly finding fault with yourself as you were found fault with as a child. But this is a game that you are playing that is destroying you. It can negate everything that I've told you, or suggested for you to think about. It can negate everything that you're trying to do. Now, when it comes into your mind, I'll tell you four words to put in its place. When you find yourself on some day thinking, if only, if only, if only, try putting these four words in their place. There is always now. There is always now. And that's what there always was. And that is what there will always be. Always, 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 in those years that were past, there was always now. And when you are 1 minute away from your last breath, there will always be now. I've got a few minutes left for questions, if you want to throw them at me. Yes. No, I resigned at the end of the year, but I resigned, I walked away on my terms. The question was, did I stay with the agency? You see, that shows you.
Alan, you said renounce remorse. How specifically do you go about doing it?
The question was, how do you renounce remorse? And as I said, I thought the whole thing we did in picking it up in our mental fingers and looking at it, realizing it, that it is an anger directed against ourselves, a disappointment in ourselves that is an echo of that same childhood thing of constantly being found fault with, constantly being told that we could do better, you simply don't do it anymore. You don't do it. And that you are capable of that. See, this if only and the remorse are all tied together. In the first place, you can't do anything about the past. It's gone. It's dead. It's the only thing you can do with the past is learn from it. That's the only use it has to you. Any other use you make of it is going to be a neurotic and a destructive use. The only way you can use the past is to look back at it and learn from it. But you quit regretting it. You quit being remorseful about it. You just stop. That's all. Just like you stop drinking. Just like you stop anything else. You just don't do it. There's no special trick. You realize what it is, that it is a neurotic thing, that it is not a virtue. It does not make you good in the eyes of God to go around saying, gee whiz, why did I do that? I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. This does not make you into a saint. So if it does make you into a saint, what's the use? Let it go. Any other questions? How do you stop competing without falling by the wayside? Is that what you said? Well, that's what I tried to bring out. I was in a highly competitive business, and I stopped competing. When I say stop competing, I don't mean that you come to work and sit with your hands folded until they fire you. I mean, you do what you have to do. You do the duties that are given to you with everything that you've got. But you don't add to those all kinds of little hanky-panky, like tearing the other guy down, trying to outsmart him, trying to put yourself up at the other guy's expense. You see, any time you show yourself off to good advantage. It won't work unless you show somebody else off to a disadvantage. And this is all I'm saying. You simply stop. Whether the business is competitive or not. Let's take bricklayer. I don't know anything about bricklaying. And maybe it's a highly competitive business. But it finally comes down to the guy who lays the brick best and the bricks stay where they're put. He keeps getting work. I'm sure. Any other questions?
I'm trying to work the program and trying to carry out some of your suggestions, but I'm leaving to try thinking a lot of that myself. And that's part of the problem. I've talked too much about myself in the past already. And when I think too much about myself, what happens is I start feeling sort of unreal. Like I'm driving down the freeway, and the brain starts to work on some of this stuff. All of a sudden, it's like I'm not really there. It's like I'm watching a movie that's part of the freeway. So what I'd like to know is, does anyone else ever experience that? And what do you do about it?
The question is, in thinking about myself and trying to apply these rules of self-knowledge, there's a tendency for the world to become unreal, the real world to become unreal, and it's like watching a movie of the real world while I think about myself. I never had this. I was able to think about myself while juggling. So I really don't know. I can't imagine why. If you're having a conversation with somebody in your job or anything, I don't think then that in under those circumstances that you can be start all of a sudden a blank look come over your face and you start thinking about yourself. But I believe that you can wash your teeth, shave, and a lot of other things, drive cars, sit alone, and you know. I've been able to think about myself while carrying on conversation. As a matter of fact, I was having a lot better conversation with myself while I was carrying on the other conversation. I'm sorry, I don't know how to answer that question. If the real world starts getting unreal, I'd quit doing what you're doing. Whatever it is you're doing, don't do it. If you're on the freeway and it begins to look unreal, do go back to doing what you used to do. You know, it's only my opinion, you know. Any other questions? Yes,
Shirley. That young man, and it's, I think, a good question, if that's what you meant, or even if you didn't. It's part of his own problem, his self-involvement, and in trying to think things that you have spoken of, that he finds himself getting just as self-involved as he was before. And I thought he wanted to know whether anybody else had this problem, but... You know, that the self-involvement is being multiplied or accelerated, and he felt that that was one of his problems before.
Well, if that's... Shirley says that maybe what he was talking about was self-involvement. I do not know any technique by which you can find out what is going on inside of you and what is motivating you and what is... causing you to think and feel the way you think and feel without becoming involved with yourself. I don't know of any way that you can do this. Now, I know that it is a great maxim to say, well, get interested in others. I'm going back again to the line in the book that says, see to it that your own house is in order, because obviously you cannot transmit something you do not have. If working with others becomes a substitute, mind you, I am not putting down working with others, because this, if self-esteem does not express itself and find an outlet and an expression in now sharing your own feeling of self-approval with everyone in your life, then you don't really have self-approval. I think it goes back to the precept of in the Bible of love your neighbor as you love yourself. I don't see how in the world you can live your life without being at all times involved with yourself. I think we were talking here in a semantic tightrope feather dance here of whether you're involved with yourself or whether you're not. If working with others so that you don't think about yourself becomes a substitute for what I've been talking about, in my own actual experience, trying to do this for 3.5 years, it didn't work. All it did was postpone and make more difficult and more agonized and more tormenting what I finally had to do. I can only speak for myself. As I say, if anything is causing you distress, then let's go back to rule number one. Let's look at the evidence. That was number two rule. whatever you're doing, if the results are not good, then back up and look at the evidence and arrive at your own decision. The statement was that in the beginning, it was when you tried to think about yourself, it was too painful, and it got all mixed up. Now, after a certain amount of sobriety, starting again, and it's easier. If you were here, I forgot to point it out tonight. I did it all the other four. If you're new, and you've only been sober a matter of days or weeks, you have only one thing to do. You stay away from the first drink. That's all you have to do. That is all you have to do. It's your only problem for a long, long time, is you just stay away from the first drink. Do anything else. This stuff that I'm talking about will come when you feel that you have to do it. And as a matter of fact, when you feel that you have to do it, is the only time that it'll ever really be of any use. And maybe you will never feel the need for it. These are not Ten Commandments that I've been talking about. It's things that I had to do, and I'm putting them out in front of you in case, and for only with the idea that they may be of help to you. I know that a lot of times when I or anybody else, but probably especially me in these last few weeks up here putting out with all this stuff, it's probably, and very legitimately, some of you have thought, well, I wonder if that joker ever puts his money where his mouth is. I tried to tell you tonight some instances where I have. The things that I've told you, I have lived. These aren't theories that I have read or brought out of a book. And as a matter of fact, I want to close with one that just recently, and that is last October when I was seriously considering whether or not I should resign. I called up a friend of mine in New York, in our New York office. He's a member of the board of directors, and he'd been, I guess, one of the closest friends that I've had in the company. And I told him how I felt, that I wanted to go away, that I figured that I'd put up with this enough. And remind you, I was leaving this agency about 10 or 12 years before I needed to. And his advice to me was, well, Mike, why don't you just sit there and let the meter run? And I put the phone down, and I thought, God, thank God I called Al, because he's a great, wise, practical guy. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to sit here, I'm going to take it easy, I'm going to enjoy myself, and I'm going to let the meter run. I'm going to let all that stock and that profit sharing, all that stuff pile up. And 10 or 12 years from now, I can walk out of here, and I'll really be healed. About an hour later, this thought kept going on in my mind. All of a sudden, it dawned on me that it was my meter that was running. It was my meter that was running. And ladies and gentlemen, the day you were born, the flag went down, and the meter has been running ever since. And if I could leave you with one thought, it's make the trip count. Because you're paying for it, whether you like it or not. The flag is down. When you wake up in the morning, it will be the beginning of the first day of the rest of your life. And every day after that will be the first day of the rest of your life. And I tell you, make it count. Make it count. Be unreal. Make mistakes. There's too damn much fear being preached in AA today. In my opinion, you hear it from all sides. You know, the newcomer comes in and he's given a list of don'ts that would stagger a mule. Don't get married, don't not get married. Don't change your job, don't not change your job. Don't eat, don't not eat. Don't diet, don't do it. Don't stand up, don't sit down, don't go there, don't there. I'm going to tell you, do. There's only three don'ts that I tell you. Don't pretend, don't be afraid, don't run away. It is later, I don't care how young you are or how old you are, it is later than you know. So make it count. Make it count. Life is for the living. Dare to live. Dare to move out. Dare to be vulnerable. Dare to be hurt. Dare to experience life. You've been running away all of your life. Now, turn around. And if you have found something in AA that works for you, don't hold on to it and don't clutch it. Don't turn this organization, I beg of you, into a ghetto where we're going to hide and lick our wounds, coining childish little defensive words like normsy and alky while we point to out there And God, oh God, and we all hang together in here in fear and hold each other's hands. If you found something here of compassion, understanding, dignity, take it in your hands and go out there. Out there. And